From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Australia expects full accountability for the deaths of aid workers, which is completely unacceptable. Aid workers and those doing humanitarian work, and indeed all innocent civilians, need to be provided with protection.
Israel's facing global condemnation after an Israeli airstrike in Gaza killed six international aid workers from Chef Jose Andres' charity World Central Kitchen and their Palestinian driver, just after they unloaded more than 100 tons of food aid that had been brought by ship from Cyprus. We'll go to Gaza for the latest. Meanwhile, the Biden administration continues to send a massive amount of arms to Israel, including 1,800 2,000-pound bombs that are strong enough to level city blocks. We'll speak to former State Department official Josh Paul and a U.S. soldier who's refusing to remain silent.
I'm Larry Hebert. I'm active duty Air Force, and I'm in Washington, D.C., conducting a hunger strike outside of the White House. I'm on day three of my hunger strike, and next week I'll be outside of Congress in solidarity with the people in Gaza.
Plus, Iran is vowing revenge after Israel attacked the Iranian consulate in Damascus, killing at least seven Iranian officers, including three commanders. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
The World Central Kitchen has suspended aid operations in Gaza after an Israeli airstrike killed six international workers from the charity and their Palestinian driver. The aid workers were struck after they left a warehouse in Deir al-Balah, where it had unloaded more than 100 tons of food aid that they had brought into Gaza by ship from Cyprus to help avert a looming famine. The aid workers were driving in a clearly marked convoy branded with the charity's logo. World Central Kitchen said the attack occurred even though the charity had coordinated in advance about the convoy with the Israeli military. The killed aid workers include three British nationals, an Australian, a Polish national, and an American-Canadian dual citizen. Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese condemned the attack.
We certainly have already contacted the Israeli government directly. We are contacting the Israeli ambassador to ask for accountability here. The truth is that this is beyond any reasonable circumstances. Someone going about providing aid and humanitarian assistance should lose their life. And there were four aid workers as well as Palestinian driver in this vehicle. This is a human tragedy that should never have occurred. That is completely unacceptable.
Earlier today, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu appeared to acknowledge Israel carried out the attack, saying, quote, unfortunately, over the last day, there was a tragic incident of an unintended strike of our forces on innocent people in the Gaza Strip, unquote. The United Nations aid coordinator for the occupied Palestinian territory, Jamie McGoldrick, said, quote, this is not an isolated incident. As of March 20th, at least 196 humanitarians had been killed in the occupied Palestinian territory since October 2023. This is nearly three times the death toll recorded in any single conflict in a year, they said. We begin today's show in Rafah, Gaza, where we're joined by the Gaza-based journalist Akram Al-Sattari. Akram, thanks so much for joining us again. What do you understand took place? Talk about Chef Jose Andres' charity workers who were killed and their driver, what they were doing.
They were helping people. They were trying to secure the food aid for the people in Gaza, whom they were in touch with, whom they were eating with, whom they were in solidarity with, whom they were thinking, they deserve to be treated as humans, and they deserve to be safe, and they deserve to be secured. However, they themselves, the ones who were there extending the helping hand, ended up being killed by an Israeli attack, the circumstances of which are not clear yet, neither to the government of Israel that apparently ordered the attack, no matter what the circumstances are, nor to the Palestinians who have been seeing at least foreigners there with them extending a helping hand and trying to secure a lifeline while their lives were taken by that Israeli attack.
And Akram, how does this happen when reportedly World Central Kitchen was coordinating its efforts and was informing the Israelis of where its aid workers were?
Well, this is the fact that shocked everyone. And as a matter of fact, many other international aid workers and some UNRWA workers also were affected by the ongoing bombardment. UNRWA made a specific statement about the number of UNRWA staff who were killed, which is around 166 UNRWA staff who were killed while they are on job, while they're moving from their places to their duty stations, and when they're back from their duty stations to their homes, or even when they're still conducting their job in their duty station, extending a helping hand to the people. The coordinates are very well clear for the Israeli army. This is a protocol that has been followed ever since the war has started. Every single humanitarian aid worker that is extending a helping hand in Gaza, that is coordinating or helping or distributing food or doing anything, is already recognized by the Israeli army. And the incident took place, and I think it's the full responsibility of the Israeli government now to clarify and to provide justification, and not in the sense that justification of the killing itself, but rather demystify the circumstances that led to that catastrophic incident, given that it is not unprecedented event where many others lost their lives because of the way Israeli army has been dealing with the general population in Gaza and with the facilities that are supposed to be protected. As you have just said, the car was marked as a World Central Kitchen car. The staff who are there were already recognized by the Israeli army, and they are very well aware that they are moving while the Israeli army is aware of their very movement. The coordinates of the warehouse that they were entering and leaving in Deir el-Balah is also well known for the Israelis. The place they were unloading the goods and the food items for the people of Gaza are also well known by the Israeli army. However, the incident took place, and I think it's upon the Israeli government to explain to the world and to the different countries, including Canada, USA, Poland, and also the Poland, and I think UK, for how this happened and why this happened.
And has there been any improvement in the last week or two of the of supplies coming into Gaza, to especially food and medical supplies?
Well, the food and medical supplies are still very scarce in the Gaza Strip. The different UN figures have been voicing their concern over the fact that Israel is limiting all the supplies that are entering Gaza. Even more, Israel is being selective about what enters Gaza and what doesn't enter Gaza. The Palestinian health system at large sustained a very big blow, a very big strike, when the Ashifa hospital was totally destroyed. It lost 800 beds, it lost 100 dialysis machines, and it also lost one-third of the therapeutic services throughout the Gaza Strip. So the situation is dire, and it continues to get even worse. And Israel is not willing, or is not able, to allow more food supplies and medical supplies into the Gaza Strip. Not far away from us is Abu Yusuf al-Najjar Hospital in Rafah. The hospital is suffering because of the fact they have access to very limited supplies, and they have been calling for the international community, they have been calling for the world, they have been calling even for Israel to allow unhindered access of the medical supplies and food supplies to help the people. They have a place for the people with dialysis that need dialysis machines, and those people need to have some nutritional need, and those needs are not met. And if the situation continues the way it is, even the urgent and immediate medical needs of those people are not going to be met, which compromises their whole life.
I want to talk about this in the context of the looming famine. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinians pushed to the brink of famine right now. AP is reporting Cyprus, which has played a key role in trying to establish a sea route to bring food into the territory, said ships that recently arrived were turning back with some 240 tons of undelivered aid. The World Kitchen, Chef Jose Andres's food charity, was the first to get massive amount of food into Gaza, and now we see what has happened to them. I'm wondering, Akram, are you hungry? Is your family hungry?
This is a very critical question. For you to understand, I am a Gazan. Gazan means I am living the very same circumstances that my people are living. Sometimes it's Ramadan time, and sometimes we eat one meal a day. Sometimes the meal is not as decent as you imagine for someone who's fasting for around 16 hours. This is the situation for most of the people in the Gaza. But to make a difference, people in the south of Gaza are living a little bit better life than the ones who are living in the northern Gaza. The World Central Bank organized that trip with an intention of delivering the 200 tons of food that were delivered initially in the very first pilot trip to Gaza North and Gaza City, where 700,000 Palestinians are besieged and are denied any access whatsoever, except for very limited quantities, since 1 month and a half up to this particular moment. Now, the 1,000 tons that were allowed into, the 200 tons and the 1,000 tons were not allowed into Gaza North and Gaza City, where 700,000 people are waiting for the food. The famine is not looming. The famine is already taking place. We have around 34 Palestinians, adult and young, who died from the starvation. We have many more people who are complaining about the significant loss of their wealth. We have people and children who are eager to eat anything whatsoever, anything whatsoever. People in the north ate the grass, ate whatever they can eat. They eat also the animal feed. They are sorting it out, they're cleaning it, they're grinding it, they're making bread out of it. And even when the taste and the smell is not what you expect as a human, they still have to eat it because they don't have any other option. That situation continues to be very dire, and that situation continues to deteriorate. Now, some people organized and formed some special committees for the sake of just receiving the food that is allowed, the minimum food that is allowed from the road between Rafah, Khan Yunis, and Gaza, Salah Hadin Road. And those people ended up being targeted. 70 of them were killed, and more than 500 Palestinians were killed in different incidents targeting the people around Al-Kuwait roundabout and Annabulsi roundabout when they're waiting for the food, when they're waiting for to eat. 20 different incidents of targeting that took the life of 500 Palestinians and 70 of those who are working to organize everything. The way that is now done, the way that this targeting is done indicates that Israel is willing to deprive those people from any hope and any life whatsoever.
Well, Akram al-Sattari, we want to thank you for being with us, speaking to us from Rafah in Gaza. And we have this latest news from the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. It's just reported new details about the deadly strike on Chef Andres's World Central Kitchen aid workers. The newspaper writes, quote, at some point when the convoy was driving along the approved route, the war room of the unit responsible for security of the route ordered the drone operators to attack one of the cars with a missile. Some of the passengers were seen leaving the car after it was hit and switching to one of the other two cars. They continued to drive and even notified the people responsible that they were attacked, but seconds later, another missile hit their car. The third car in the convoy approached, and the passengers began to transfer to it the wounded who'd survived the second strike in order to get them out of danger. But then a third missile struck them. All seven World Central Kitchen volunteers were killed in the strike. That again, Haaretz reporting the Israeli military ordered the drone strikes mistakenly, thinking a member of Hamas was part of the aid convoy. The deadly attack on the World Central Kitchen convoy comes as the Biden administration continues to send massive amounts of arms to Israel. Reuters is reporting the Biden administration is considering a new $18 billion arms package for Israel that would include dozens of F-15 fighter jets. This is in addition to the recent U.S. approval of 1,800 2,000-pound bombs and 500-pound bombs, as well as 25 F-35 fighter jets. We're joined now by Josh Paul, a veteran State Department official who worked on arms deals and resigned in protest of a push to increase arms sales to Israel amidst its siege on Gaza. He's the former director of Congressional and Public Affairs for the Bureau of Political Military Affairs in the State Department, where he worked for 11 years. Now a non-resident fellow at Dawn, that's Democracy for the Arab World Now. Josh, thanks so much for joining us again. I mean, in light of what we are talking about right now, the world's central kitchen suspending its operations in Gaza after their six workers and their Palestinian driver were hit by airstrikes, Israeli airstrikes. Can you talk about these latest news? First, the Washington Post exposed the sale of the F-35 fighter jets and other bombs, and now Reuters talking about additional weapon sales to Israel. What this means, how they're used by Israel.
Thank you for having me. And perhaps I'll start with that latter point, because I think, you know, this is important context. The strike on the World Central Kitchen comes on the same day that Israel wrapped up its operations in Al-Shifa Hospital that has left the ground littered with decaying body parts, and nor is it by any means the first strike on humanitarian aid workers. In February, Israel murdered U.S. citizen Musa Shawa, logistics coordinator for the charity ANERA. In November, it murdered three doctors from Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders. And in December, it murdered Rima Boulebdeh, who was a board member of MSF UK. And of course, in February, after having given direct permission for an ambulance to retrieve six-year-old Hind Rajab from the car where she sat with the bodies of her dead parents, Israel struck that ambulance, killing the medics who were on their way to save her. So, you know, this is a continuing pattern. And in that context, as you note, last week, the US authorized the transfer of over 2,000 more bombs to Israel. This week, I anticipate it will authorize the transfer of 1,000 more. It has been doing this on a weekly basis since the conflict began, just an open tap of arms, and these are the arms that Israel is using to kill not only thousands of civilians, but hundreds of aid workers as well.
And Josh Paul, this use of U.S. weapons in this way by Israel, we're talking about not only the killing of aid workers, but the attack on consular offices this week in Syria, of the diplomatic offices of Iran, and the banning of Al Jazeera. What does U.S. law say about how weapons can be used by states that receive them from the United States? And when it comes to violations of human rights?
Well, that's a very good question. And there are a variety of laws that should, in theory, apply here, ranging from the requirement that U.S.-provided arms be used in accordance with international law to more specific laws that, for example, U.S. assistance cannot be provided to a country that is restricting the delivery of U.S.-funded humanitarian assistance. We have seen many examples of Israel restricting, if not striking, the delivery of humanitarian assistance. So I think these laws all need to be questioned, called into question. And the important thing here is that that's not what is happening. In fact, the Biden administration has on purpose not been seeking legal opinions on whether the arms we are providing to Israel are being used in accordance with the law. It has also not been seeking assessments from the intelligence community of Israel's actions using U.S. weapons. It is essentially sticking its fingers in its ears and, you know, covering its eyes and saying, you know, we don't know what's going on. It is making a purposeful decision to not know what is going on, and I have never seen anything like it in my time in government.
Is it even possible when you're dealing with 2,000-pound bombs to talk about protecting civilian life as Israel continues to do?
Not in the context of a place like Gaza. This is an area, you know, the size of Metro Cleveland, basically, and it has dropped thousands of these bombs in that space. It is impossible in that circumstance to talk about, you know, the principles of discrimination and proportionality that are central to the laws on conflict and international humanitarian law.
On Monday, journalists questioned U.S. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller about the latest U.S. arms transfer to Israel.
I understand the fulfillment can take years, but are you basically saying that the authorization of the transfer coming in these recent weeks was a coincidence?
I'm not saying it's a coincidence. Israel has been engaged in a military conflict, and of course when you are engaged in a military conflict, you deplete your military stocks.
So there was a request in recent weeks for the additional fulfillment of these particular weapons.
As is always the case, I'm not getting into the timings of exact requests from here. I'll be quick. But this is a process that we keep Congress fully apprised of, our relevant committees. But when you see these types of requests and when they get publicly reported, you have to remember that Israel is in an armed conflict and is expending a great deal of defense material, and some of that needs to be replenished for Israel's long-term security.
Right. And my final thing on this is, like, Secretary and a lot of senior officials from this administration basically said far too many Palestinians have been killed. But when you go and make the... And we know that the administration's policy hasn't changed. It is not conditioning weapons to Israel. But when you go and make such an authorization of the transfer in recent weeks, even if the actual weapons transfer has been approved years ago, don't you think that is going to damage the weight of your word, your credibility, and basically your sincerity in saying that far too many Palestinians have been killed?
So I do not agree with that at all. We have been very clear that we want to see Israel do everything it can to minimize civilian casualties. We have made clear that they need to operate at all times in full compliance with international humanitarian law. At the same time, we are committed to Israel's right to self-defense.
And just to follow up, a 2,000-pound bomb is self-defense, in your opinion?
So they need to have the ability to defend themselves against a very well-armed adversary. Like I said, Iran, Hezbollah, which has thousands and thousands of fighters and quite sophisticated material and quite sophisticated weaponry, as we've seen them deploy, against Israel in the last few days. So yes, they do need the modern military equipment to defend themselves against
those
adversaries.
In Gaza,
And we have made clear to them that whatever weapon they use in Gaza, be it a bomb, be it a tank round, be it anything, that we expect them to use those weapons in full compliance with international humanitarian law. And we have had very frank conversations with them about the fact that there far too many civilians have died through their operations, and that they need to do better in taking into account the need to minimize civilian harm. And we'll continue to do that.
And this is State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller just last week.
We have not found them to be in violation of international humanitarian law, either when it comes to the conduct of the war or when it comes to the provision of humanitarian assistance.
I assume, Josh Paul, that you know Matthew Miller well. You worked at the State Department for 11 years. Your response?
So I think there's a lot to unpack there. Just going back to his last point, again, the point here is that they have not found Israel to not be in compliance with international law because they have not asked their own lawyers whether that is the case or not. So for as long as they do not ask the question, they do not get the answer that they do not want. He also noted, and the reporter who was interviewing him noted, that this was a case formally approved by Congress. This was for the F-35s. This was a case for F-35s approved by Congress in 2008. That was before the first significant Israel-Hamas exchange of fire in 2009. Now in the context of an immediate and ongoing conflict. So the idea that you can take an authorization that Congress gave in a peacetime context, in a completely different context, and say that this gives us the approval to move forward with these arms transfers now in this new context is very questionable. And of course, as was also noted, Israel is continuing to use these bombs regardless of what Matt said. That it may be able to use them against Hezbollah or against Iran. It is using them in Gaza. And by continuing to provide these arms at the rate that we are doing so, what we are essentially doing is letting Israel choose wherever it wishes to use them rather than forcing it to make the hard choice of what is actually the threat for which it needs these weapons.
Josh Paul, we want to thank you very much for being with us. Veteran State Department official who worked on arms deals and resigned in protests of a push to increase arms sales to Israel amidst its siege in Gaza. He's now a non-resident fellow at Democracy for the Arab World Now, or DAWN. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to an active duty member of the U.S. Air Force who started a hunger strike Sunday outside the White House to demand an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. Senior Airman Larry Hebert has been holding a sign that reads, "Active duty airman refuses to eat while Gaza starves. He's on day three of his hunger strike while on leave from his duty station in Spain. Larry says he was inspired in part by the actions of Aaron Bushnell, the 25-year-old active duty member of the U.S. Air Force who set himself on fire in front of the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C. in February to demand a Gaza ceasefire. He died. Senior Airman Larry Hebert joins us now from Washington, D.C., where he's also hoping to meet with members of Congress. He's a member of Veterans for Peace. Larry, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you explain your hunger strike in front of the White House?
Yes, thank you. And thank you for having me on, ma'am. I appreciate it. So my hunger strike is obviously in solidarity with the civilians in Gaza. It's just completely wrong and immoral for, civilians to be starved and bombed and targeted in any manner. So that's what the hunger strike is specifically for.
And Larry, you took an authorized leave from your assignment at your naval station in Spain to do this protest. How did you get the permission, and what's been the response of your superiors?
Well, to take authorized leave, that's earned just through, continuing my service. There's no specifics on what I have to provide them as far as what I'll be doing on leave. Just that I am taking leave and where roughly I am going.
Have you gotten response from them, given what you're doing as you stand in front of the White House conducting your hunger strike?
I've had a couple members from my command reach out, and I expect to speak to my commander fairly soon.
You want to become a conscientious objector?
Yes. I think that's one of the routes that can be taken. While that process is going, if my command wants to work with me and work out a deal where I'm in either a reassignment or possibly some sort of mutual discharge, I would accept that as well.
And you've mentioned the tragedy of Aaron Bushnell and how that affected your outlook and decision. Could you talk about that a little more?
Yeah, so what Aaron did was courageous and emotional. For me, it really resonated because, what he was feeling was exactly how I was feeling. And obviously I'm not going to that extent. I don't think anyone needs to. I think what he did was unique and was effective. But what really infuriated me was the silence thereafter his actions. I don't know a single member of our government or leaders in the military that really spoke on Aaron, even uttered his name. But I had seen people in Yemen and in Gaza and holding up his picture and sending their condolences, and I even saw the official statement from Hamas, who is a deliberate enemy of our military and our government. They issued an official statement sending their condolences to Aaron and his family. So it really broadened my perspective to see, even our adversaries speaking out and sending their condolences to our own military members.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. I know this is one of the first TV interviews you've done, and you are on the third day of your hunger strike. Larry Hebert, active duty Air Force senior airman, on hunger strike for a ceasefire in Gaza, member of Veterans for Peace, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Extinction Diaries. There are 6 known freshwater dolphin species, all highly adaptive, yet 5 are in immediate danger of extinction. A 7th, known as the Baiji or Chinese Yangtze River dolphin, was declared extinct in 2006. 4 of the 6 remaining species and a few subspecies are in Asia, and 2 others are struggling in the Amazon. Pollution is weakening and killing these incredible freshwater cetaceans. For instance, mercury poisoning from Amazon gold mining is killing the pink bodu, and Chinese factory runoff was a major factor in the Baiji extinction. Damming rivers, increased agriculture, accidental entanglement, and overfishing the dolphins' food sources are also prime causes of depopulation. There may be only 950 Ganges River dolphins, as few as 150 Irrawaddy, and 1,000 or less of the Asian finless porpoise. The speed of species depopulation is mind-boggling.